A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on February 22, 2004, entitled One Reality, Rigorous Science, Passionate Religion, in the series A Little Fair Legacy. The texts for the sermon are Isaiah 46, verses 1 to 4, and Psalm 8. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
It was in the summer of 2001 that I read Gary Dorian's volume 1 of his History of the American Liberal Tradition, American Liberal Theology. Gary Dorian is distinguished professor at Kalamazoo College, and contrary to what Jesus said, he is not without honor in his own neighborhood. I esteem him highly. He's been here a couple of times. He's led a weekend for us. He preached last Palm Sunday. And he is a prolific scholar, and he has a breadth and depth of understanding of the history of ideas, and particularly American culture and American theological development, such that I've not run into before. Professor Dorian was in the end of his first volume hinted that in volume two he would be dealing with the late 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, and I must have found there some reference to the Chicago School. And of course Duncan Littlefair was a spokesperson for that Chicago School, the University of Chicago, in the first half of the 20th century. Duncan was probably the most eloquent voice to give interpretation and translation of the Chicago School theology in this country. And so on a whim, I had not met Gary Dorian before, but on a whim I called him up and I said, how would you like to meet perhaps the last living voice of the Chicago School? And he, with great curiosity, of course, you know, said, well, I'd love to do that. So I arranged a meeting, August 8, 2001, at the Schnitzelbank in Grand Rapids between Duncan Littlefair and Gary Dorian. And Duncan, you know, was never impressed with academic people. This Gary Dorian is too handsome and too young to be as erudite as he is. And so Duncan talked about the Chicago School, and Gary would ask him an occasional question. We had an hour together. It was a very pleasant encounter, I thought. Duncan wasn't too impressed. He didn't think this young man asked him enough questions or probed it deeply enough or really heard anything he said. But when volume two was published, there on page 525, 545, these words. Duncan had commented that the Chicago School of Theology had lost its nerve in the 1940s. And then in the insert, you don't have to look at it, but in the insert I did put some stuff about the Chicago School. The last paragraph has Duncan's quote in Gary Dorian's volume 2. This is Duncan. Mielen and Loomer were my friends, but they ruined the Chicago School of Theology. Here we had a breakthrough in theology, a major new school in the making. Wyman showed how you could take a thoroughly naturalistic approach to theology, one that dropped all the garbage about revelation and the supernatural, and they refused to keep it going. The direction that Mielen and Loomer took was worthless. Theology stopped making progress after Wyman left Chicago, and it hasn't made any progress since. You had to love him, you know. He was so grouchy, but he was convinced that that was, as a matter of fact, that was true. Last June, when my successor coming up, Ian Lawton, was here, and we had Duncan up here, and Ian, he said to Ian, when did Christian theology get off the track? And Ian, I could see him quaver a little bit, and he tried, you know, what's he after? And he said, well, I suppose almost immediately. Duncan said, no, middle 40s. And that's really what he believed. That theological breakthrough that had been accomplished at the Chicago School had gotten derailed. As a matter of fact, it did in the mid-40s. It was swept away by what we call neo-orthodoxy, names like Tillich and Niebuhr and Karl Barth, which is a consequence of the sociology of the time that was post-World War I, post-Depression. People were not really moved very much by Henry Nelson Wyman, who was the mentor of Duncan, the reason for which Duncan came to Chicago. And Duncan became really the translator of Wyman, the most eloquent. He was better. He told Wyman better than Wyman told Wyman's self. And Duncan felt very definitely that movement that sidetracked the Chicago School had effectively hindered any further progress in theological understanding, because he indeed believed that he went to Chicago because he read Wyman's book, The Wrestle of Religion with Truth. I remember him telling me, I turned every page just waiting for Wyman to take back what he had given, waiting for Wyman to betray his thesis. But he didn't. I got to the end of the book and I said, that's it. And here was this poor kid from Canada, from the streets of Canada, showing up at the University of Chicago with no money because he wanted to study with Wyman, because the wrestle of religion with truth had spoken to him, and he said, that's it. That's where it's got to go. And as a matter of fact, he did his work there, and he did become the finest interpreter of Wyman's work. But Wyman's work, the Chicago School, did get sidetracked. And for all those many years, Duncan was a voice consistent with that vision. But he pretty much stood alone, perhaps in the whole country. He was the eloquent exponent of the breakthrough of Chicago theology, but he stood alone. And what was that breakthrough? Well, that breakthrough was that reality is one. That nature, or the cosmos, or however you want to speak of it, is a unity. That our lives are a part of the cosmic reality, which is one reality. Not two realms, a realm of spirit and a realm of nature, a realm of the supernatural or the dwelling place of God, and then the realm of nature, material, matter, with human beings being the creatures who have their feet thoroughly rooted in the mud and their spirits soaring in the clouds, tugged from below and beckoned from above. No. That dualism was done away with in the Chicago School understanding of reality. It was one reality. And the human experience was understood within the parameters of that one reality. And the religious experience and the experience of God as well was sought within the limits of that one reality. That breakthrough was the consequence of the cumulative effect of three centuries of the natural sciences and the implementation of the scientific method, empirical investigation, all of the tools of the natural sciences by which, increasingly, since the 17th century, we have come to understand the nature of the reality of the cosmos, of nature, of all that is. That scientific endeavor proved so successful, so powerful, and so fruitful. And one would expect that that knowledge would have been celebrated. Look at what we have learned. Look at what we understand today as the consequence of the scientific endeavor. We know that we're a part of a process of 13.7 billion years. We know that we are the consequence of exploding stars. We are stardust. We know about the expanding universe. We know about the depths of space and the eons of time. We know about nature. We know about human anatomy. The compass of the scientific endeavor is just mind-boggling. And absolutely marvelous. The human creature coming eventually along this process to the point of being able to understand this process. 13.7 billion years, elements all over the place, coalescing, cooling, billions of years. Eventually life, conscious life, human life, and all of those ultimate questions that come with the consciousness of being human. And here we are. This cosmic process of billions of years has emerged into a moment like this when the likes of us sit down together and think about these things. It's absolutely mind-boggling. It's wonderful. Everybody celebrated it, right? Wrong. Not everybody celebrated that breakthrough in understanding. Because, as a matter of fact, ancient religion was synonymous with ancient science. For people in ancient times had the same questions we do. The psalmist must have been on some starry night gazing into the heavens. Said, "O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. When I consider the sun, the moon, the stars which you've made, who am I that you'd be mindful of me?" And yet he had the sense, here I am, this little mortal, but it is I who am contemplating the vastness of space. And then I realize, you've made me a little less than yourself. And I'm not going to go into the Isaiah story, but there too was a transformation in religious understanding from the cycles of nature, which marked the Babylonian religion, to that sense of Israel, who had a sense of the God who was moving in the course of history. So the ancient people were religious because they were human. They, as well as we, asked ultimate questions about why is there something rather than nothing? From whence have we come? What is our destiny? What does it all mean? And is this all there is? Now, in the explanation for ancient folk, there were ancient texts, like the Bible, in our case. And those texts gave explanation not only for those ultimate questions, but also questions about knowledge about the universe, about creation. And now science comes along and begins to uncover the mysteries and the wonders of the created order, and it runs counter to the storybook. And so begins the conflict between science and religion. And the stuff of the natural sciences, you know, how can you refute it? And yet, as we speak, in the Michigan legislature, there are three or four bills having to do with the teaching of creationism in school. I mean, as we speak in the 21st century, that conflict goes on. It's unbelievable. But, as a matter of fact, when you had nature being opened up by the sciences, and you had an ancient text which had been absolutized and made authoritative, you had to deal with it. And there were at least three options. The first option is still carried on by fundamentalist Christians across the board. You simply reject science. I don't know how you can do it intelligently, because the stuff of science is verifiable. And when the scientist builds models or paradigms, and then there's some other data out here, and eventually that data cannot be worked into this paradigm, then the paradigm is dismantled and a new paradigm is created to incorporate further data. That's the process of science. That's the glory of science. They're always trying to disprove themselves. Well, the glory of religion is that we never try to disprove ourselves. So, one response would be to this grand explosion and eruption of knowledge, just reject it and keep reading the book. But not many thinking and intelligent and mature human beings can get away with that for long. Eventually it catches up with you. Particularly if you want a heart transplant or a liver transplant, or you don't usually pray about that, you look for an awfully good scientist. That may be the test, the acid test. So the other choice would be just reject religion. And an awful lot of good folks have done that. Their number is legion, huh? I used to say to Duncan, you know what? The congregations that you and I ought to have, most of them have left the church. He said, yeah, that's right. Because if you're thoughtful about these things, and if you look at the data, and then you are told that that can't be true, if you have this book as an absolute that's a template that has to be laid on experience so that the only truth can be what can be squeezed into this template, finally you just give up. And it's tragic whether you reject the science or you reject the religion. There's a third option. And that is the option of those who have said, obviously, the scientific endeavor is marvelous. And we celebrate that. And we take that knowledge. But on the other hand, when we have learned everything we can learn about this 13.7 billion year process, when we know about the human anatomy, when we know about the environment and the weather and the rainforest, and when we know about everything that science investigates, there's still a hole in the soul. There's still the ultimate questions. There's still that spiritual dimension. And so the third option would be give up the authority. Shades of last week. Give up your authority in terms of an external authority imposed on human experience or imposed on human reason. Give it up. and take in as much as you can from the scientific perspective and celebrate the miracle and the wonder with awareness and attention. Lift your glass to this unfolding miracle of life. And then, having been given a sense of the nature of that one reality, figure out how to be religious. Or figure out how to release the spirit. Or figure out how to enhance the highest and noblest ideals that have come to expression in the human being. Accept the portrait of rigorous science, but know then you're still only half a person, and cultivate that spiritual dimension, that creativity that is at the center of things. Recognize that when you are not self-created. Dunk used to say, "You didn't make yourself," which was kind of a grudging nod to God, or mystery, or creative interchange, or however you want to define it, however you want to call it. Simply the recognition that this marvelous landscape of the cosmos into which our lives have been woven has emerged in the likes of us who have another dimension about us, a spiritual dimension, if you will, and to value that and to cultivate that and then to work at living religiously in that given universal setting that has been so marvelously explained by all of the sciences. If you do that, if you give up that ultimate, that external authority, that authoritarian religion, whether it be an ecclesiastical institution or a book or a tradition, whatever, if you give that up, get free of it, take in life as it is, and then learn how to live religiously and to cultivate the spirit. Doing that, you are a liberal. That's a definition of a liberal. The Orthodox have the I's dotted, the T's crossed. They have a faith to defend. They can't open their eyes to the wonder of the reality around them, because the script is written. The liberal said, "I'm going to let the script go. I want to see. I want to taste. I want to experience. And I want to do it as a human being with soul, with spirit." That was a liberal. And if you were a certain kind of a liberal, because there are all nuances of liberalism too, if you were a Chicago liberal, you were a modernist. And if you were a modernist in the Chicago school, then in that one reality, you sought God in the structures of history and the creative cosmic movement. One reality. But your religion is totally naturalistic. And to have naturalistic religion doesn't mean you live without God. It means that you find God within the one reality. And your devotion and your spiritual life is lived within the parameters of that one reality, celebrating the creative process or name it what you will, then you are a Chicago school modernist. And Duncan was probably the most eloquent exponent of that particular theological understanding. Rigorous science, passionate religion. And the religion that is the consequence of that vision is so healthy. It is mature. It is intelligent. That religion enhances human being and creates human community. I had my usual Saturday morning misery session with the Grand Rapids Press religion section yesterday. And next Sunday I'll get to Mel Gibson's Passion. But I let that go today. But the little story again about the traditionalist Catholics who went to the Basilica in Grand Rapids and disrupted the prayers of the Buddhists who had been invited to do their prayers and their chants in the Catholic Basilica. The Grand Rapids Press article says that that story even made the USA Today. And apparently now this little group that meets in the former Second Christian Reformed Church in Allendale, I know that that is a holy place because our judge Ed Post grew up there. Ed would sit in Christ Community and he'd play a game with me. He said he'd wonder at what point in the sermon the flag would have gone up at Second Christian Reformed Allendale when I said something which was almost unacceptable. But anyway, in that sanctuary now, there's this band of pilgrims, traditionalist Catholics, and the priest was caught speaking to his people. Now, I know the camera can play awful tricks. It can grab you in a bad visage. But I have to say, they caught the priest in an angry look. It was an angry look. And I could not believe in the article. He is quoted as saying, if going to that basilica to disrupt that service, if that was harsh and mean-spirited, then God is harsh and mean-spirited. And I thought to myself, you are absolutely right. I'm so glad you understand that. You've heard me say it many times. You reflect the God you worship. And as a matter of fact, that kind of disruption of another religious ceremony, that kind of absolutism that is embodied in that group, that is the embodiment of a God that is harsh and mean-spirited. Religion is so important for our health and well-being or for our dehumanization. I know from personal experience that kind of religion. Even though I had a wonderful dose of very authentic, conservative Christian religion, I still also know how you worry about whether or not your children will believe and be saved. Or if your children and you come to Jesus, whether your parents are saved. Because it's a matter of eternal salvation or damnation and all of that stuff. The heavy load, the oppressiveness, the heavy obligation. Not to set the spirit free and soaring, but to bind the spirit. Bad religion. I used to say to Dunk, how did we stay in this religious business so long? And he said, I don't know. There's so much bad religion. I know it does what has to be done for many, many people, but I want to tell you, there's a better way. Last night we spent a lovely evening at Fountain Street. The church was packed for George McGovern. And I had the privilege of sitting on his right hand at dinner. He's a lovely man. And he told us about the fact that he meets people every day who say, "I wish I had voted for you in 72. And he always says, "I wish you had too." But there's an article just appeared in the Boston Globe. The journalist James Carroll, who is the author of Constantine's Sword. Have you ever read that book I gave you? James Carroll just wrote an article. McGovern was right in 72. If you go back and look at that history, James Carroll says that not without good reason. I want to say to my dear Duncan, who was so disappointed that he seemed to be a voice in the wilderness, with all of the religious orgy that erupts all over this country, I want to say to Duncan, you are right. And your day will come again. Because there is one reality, which is being laid open with rigorous science and celebrated with passionate religion. Glory.